This is the Tim Powers Show. The views and opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of this station. The Tim Powers Show on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network. Now, here's Tim Powers.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Tim Powers Show. We have a full program for you. Before I share the guests with you and a little bit about what we'll be discussing, I just wanted to quickly pay tribute to somebody who passed away over the last few days. And that, of course, is the late Senator, the late Cabinet Minister, the late Parliamentarian Bill Romke, longtime member from Labrador, nearly 40 years of public service in Ottawa, and before that he was a teacher. The thing about Bill Romke that stands out in this day and age is that he was a gentleman. He was a fair man. He was a politician who looked to enable and not destabilize. He was somebody who sought good and not bad, not the cheap headline and not the quick fix. He was a man who mentored people over the course of his life and invested in them. He befriended me some 20 years ago, and I was a young conservative staffer at the time, and he was always there for me. We need more Bill Romkes in this world. It's too bad Bill is gone, but his memory will always live strongly with me, and I hope to pass on some of the lessons I learned from Bill about mentorship and respect and leadership to my own son. Bill Romke, thank you for all you did for Newfoundland and Labrador. Well, I think Bill Romke himself would have enjoyed tonight's show because we got a bit of politics, a bit of policy, and a lot of fun, a lot of great, engaging guests. We start the show off with our first candidate for the leadership of the NDP, Charlie Angus. You've probably heard and seen Charlie around before. Maybe you've been at a kitchen party with him in St. John's. He's from Timmins, James Bay. We have a conversation about why he's in the NDP race, what he thinks he can do, and how the NDP might be able to win back some support. You'll enjoy that. Charlie, as ever, full of energy. And a guy who doesn't lack any energy or chutzpah himself is Jerry Byrne, the provincial minister, joins me to talk about immigration and the new immigration policy he and the provincial Liberals have announced. And we get into a discussion around some of the things that people don't like to say around immigration and whether Newfoundlanders will be displaced from their jobs and how we ought to look at bringing people in while managing employment opportunities for people here in the province. It's another interview I am sure you will want to listen to. We also talked to Russell Wangerski, columnist with Transcontinental Media. You can read him in the Telegram. I enjoyed his column on Kevin O'Leary and Kevin O'Leary's sealskin coat. We go through what he thinks of Mr. O'Leary. He's had a few runs at him as well, and what some of the challenges are that Mr. O'Leary might face. Then we move away entirely from leadership politics into the realm of innovation, which was part of the big budget last week. I've got Ahmad Rascala from Blue Drop Learning on. Here is a man who's built a business, many businesses in fact, but Blue Drop Learning in particular, that's all about taking advantage of the opportunities in the innovation economy. We talk some real numbers, which I think is important in this discussion, and what disruption also means, who might be threatened, and what opportunities that are there. I think you'll want to hear that interview. Dr. Janine Hubbard of the Association of Psychologists of Newfoundland and Labrador joins us on the program. We dive into the all-party committee report on mental health and mental health service provision in Newfoundland and Labrador. We look at some of the recommendations, how quickly some of them may be achieved, challenges that will be encountered by others, and also talk about how actually, in the last 20 years, significant things have happened in this area, though more needs to be done. I know this topic is of great interest to many listeners. I encourage you to take the time to hear our conversation and give some feedback back. I want to keep profiling this issue and many other issues, but particularly mental health and mental well-being, because it truly is the scourge on so many young people today, if not managed properly. Sadly, I know too many stories this week of people in their 20s who've had terrible struggles. I won't get into them because they're personal, but always a reminder that mental health knocks at all of our doors regularly. And we also have Ian Froud joining us on today's show. He is with the St. John's Tool Library. He set it up. And yeah, my name's Tim, and I'm not much of a tool guy. I often get called a tool. Great word Patty Daly often uses. But you want to hear about Ian's project. I read this in the Telegram. I thought it was really cool. I didn't realize there were so many of these libraries around across the country. And you think about it, it makes perfect sense. There are a lot of us who aren't very handy, who use tools only occasionally. Why not have a place where you can go, unlike, say, Home Depot, where you buy it once and never use it again, and can rent a tool to get your work done? Maybe it's a new business for me. And I think it's kind of fascinating. We're talking the utility of tools when we're also talking innovation. And that's not meant to be a Tim Toolman tongue twister on this edition of the program. You're going to want to listen to all these great interviews, and they'll all be back with you shortly.
The Tim Powers Show will be right back. This is the Tim Powers Show on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Talked a lot on the Tim Powers Show about the conservative leadership race, but there is another big leadership race that's happening, and that's the leadership race for the NDP. And in Newfoundland and Labrador, we used to have fairly significant presence of the NDP. We had Jack Harris, we had Ryan Cleary, we've had many others. One of the people running for the leadership of the NDP is Charlie Angus, and I have him with me today. Charlie, how are you?
Well, I'm doing really good. I'm out here in rainy British Columbia, and I'm looking to get out to Newfoundland and Labrador as soon as I can get there.
Well, you're pretty popular out here, as I know from your times when you've ventured this way in the past. What's made you throw your hat into the ring? You've been around for a while. You've seen the highs and the lows. What made you decide this time to go for it?
Well, you know, I took a lot of lessons from that last election with Justin Trudeau. You know, the NDP, we could have made it, and we blew it. But I think when I look at the promise he offered, it gave people the sense of hope that he was going to be this new prime minister. It was going to be open government, nation to nation. And he's walking on those promises very cynically. And I find that a real danger. And I think this next election is going to be about the fight for an authentic voice. A politician is going to speak for people. And, you know, whether you're conservative or liberal or NDP, I think a lot of people are tuning out of politics because they think they don't trust them anymore, and they got good reason not to. So I want to bring some passion back, but I want to be that voice for people who feel they're being written off the political and economic map of our country.
So in Atlantic Canada, let's focus here for a moment. As I said, we had a couple of very strong members in Newfoundland and Labrador and all across the region. Like the Conservatives, they were wiped out by the Liberals in the last go-around. A lot of the NDP in this part of Canada were seen as being fighters. They were seen as being original characters who cared about the people. Can you attract some of them maybe back into the fold as well? What do you say to Atlantic Canadians when they are thinking about this leadership race and what they should be thinking about the NDP?
Well, you certainly need people who got your back. And that's the whole slogan of my campaign, got your back. And, you know, people in Atlantic Canada know what that means. You have to have someone who's in your corner who's – you don't have to in politics agree on everything with your elected member or your party. But you want people who aren't afraid – to get up on issues. And, you know, I think of Jack Harris in that last parliament. That man was such a man of integrity and fearless. You could never throw him off. And you don't want, no offense to the whole new crop, there's some good new liberals, and I like some of them, but you don't want a whole row of backbenchers who are little more than bobbleheads, like who just do what the PM tells you. You want people in there fighting for you. And I think for the New Democrats, literally, if we're going to be the party that says that we're party of working people, then we're going to have to be a little more willing to stand up and fight sometimes, and a little more willing to step outside the box, and a little more willing, I think, sometimes to be a little less scripted. We got a little too careful in that last election, and it cost us.
So how do you cut into that liberal support? Because we see this across the country. Sometimes when the left or center left is frustrated with the liberals, they do go to the NDP. The NDP, certainly at the time of Mr. Layton, was able to cut into a lot of dissatisfied progressive voters. Mr. Trudeau seems to be holding them still, even though, as you say, in certain pockets, people are getting frustrated with their Liberal MPs. How do you establish an NDP brand and identity that can take away some of those progressive voters that are still hanging out with the Liberals?
Well, I think we've got to look at the issue of the economy right now. I mean, Justin Trudeau doesn't get up in the morning without using the word middle class. In fact, you know, if you were in university and you had a Liberal Party drinking game that every time in a Liberal speech they mentioned middle class, you'd be bombed by the end of the first 5 minutes. And you're literally getting bombed economically by them, because I don't think Justin Trudeau knows what the middle class is. You know, my parents got into the middle class in their 40s. They were kids of minors. My mom quit school at 15. My dad was at 16. You know, the middle class for them was getting money to go to school and get an education, and that gave you a path for a better job. And that world's disappearing, where people are leveled with massive student debt, job insecurity, and you got a prime minister who says, this is the new normal. Well, it's not normal. More and more people are finding it harder and harder to get by. And so let's start talking about those issues. And, you know, this new reality, I call it the new working class. It's not just blue collar. I mean, I talk to professors who can't feed their kids because they're on this endless job cycle of temp work and, you know, contract work. And it's in white collar work. It's in professional work. So Justin has his vision of the middle class, which is, to me, a lot of rhetoric. I want to talk about where are the jobs, what are we doing to restore our regional economies. A lot of our regional economies have atrophied and disappeared. We've got to be willing to put some of that on the table and say, okay, what's your plan? And people should be able to push us and say, what's our plan? And that's where I think we're going to start to bring people back.
Is there an urban-rural split in the NDP? Is that something you're concerned about? You come from a strong rural region, Timmins, James Bay. You're a son of Timmins. Do you risk being isolated or described or compartmentalized by others as just the guy from the hinterland, or are you not concerned at all about that? I ask that because I see some of the debate around the NDP leadership now coalescing around the need to have somebody who can appeal in urban centers. So you've worked in Toronto, you've lived in Toronto, but how do you deal with that debate as it emerges?
Well, I think for the New Democrats, we got to get our heads on the fact that we are the party that represents the tip truck driver in Fort Mac and the bike courier in Vancouver. And both of them share a lot of the same concerns. They got to start to talk to each other. And we're the party where we do have the environmentalists and we do have the miners. And we have to be a party that's saying what brings us together is a lot greater than what divides us. And one of the real dangers in Canada is us to hide in our regional corners or our urban box or our rural box and blame the others. The real division that's really becoming clear in this country is economic. And more people, whether I'm in downtown Toronto and I hear it, or whether I'm talking to folks back home or having to go work up, you know, in Fort St. John because the local economy's gone. It's that sense of insecurity and where what's better for our kids. How come we got this level of debt? So that's the challenge for the NDP. We can bring both sides together, but we have to have a leader who knows how to talk to both downtown and the folks at the Tim Hortons. And I think I'm that guy.
Well, and you wouldn't be in the race if you didn't. You obviously have to believe that you can do it, and that's an important part of any leadership campaign. Just want to pick up on one additional thing related to that, and that is how does the NDP inflate itself as an organization right now? Because you'll remember after 2011, after you did so well, there was a lot of people who were suggesting, there were a lot of people who were suggesting that, you know, the Liberals were dead, the NDP were in ascension, and the pendulum swung over. Now there are people saying if Trudeau stays around for a while, the NDP itself is threatened. What's your take on all of that?
Well, Well, Tim, I always wish if everyone gave me a dollar every time they read the obituary of the NDP, I would have. This campaign would have been paid years ago in advance, and I'd be living off the dividends. But what we need to do is we had an incredible team, we had the best ground game we've ever had. I think it was in the end we got killed in the air war. We made some serious mistakes, and we got to admit that. But we gotta start reaching out to people and bringing them in who feel that that no politician speaks for them. I think that's a real opportunity. I think there's an arrogance that's really creeped in fast to the Liberals that they're going to have to be careful of. But I looked at a lot of really smart young people in our party last week. I want to bring that talent back in. I want to make it, God, we've got to have a little bit more fun, too. And sometimes in the NDP, we forget that, you know, we are the NDP, the New Democratic Party. So I want to make people feel that it's worth being involved, that it's fun being involved, encourage people, and get a little fire in your belly. Get out and knock on some doors, talk to some people, meet some people, and then you know exactly why you're doing it, which is to make Canada a better place.
Now, before I let you go, right now you have four other competitors in the race, or three with a fourth expected. Is that right?
Well, Pat Stogren, the veterans ombudsman,
right,
says he's in. So, and I got a lot of respect for Pat. Nikki Ashton's in. Guy Caron is in. And we have Peter Julian from the West Coast. So we got a mix of views, and you're going to start to see the divisions, not the divisions, but the differences in our points of view start to emerge very soon as we get out on the road and we start to talk with people.
And how do you win this race? Is it one member, one vote? Is that the way this particular race? I know you vote over consecutive weekends, but for anybody who's interested in participating wants to know how do you do it, give me that 30-second thumbnail sketch.
CharlieAngusNDP.ca. You just click on that link and we'll tell you everything you need to know. Don't go to the other sites. They'll mess you all up. They'll send you to the wrong place. No, it's one member, one vote. So, and right across the country. So I'm in BC this week. I'll be heading to Halifax next week. In between, it's going to be Ottawa, then down through 401. Then we're up to Saskatchewan. Then we're getting back out. I want to get out to St. John's because I promised some kitchen parties while I'm out there with my guitar. So that's how I'm going to pay for this tour, Tim, is I'm doing kitchen parties. You want Charlie Angus to, you know, this is, you know, Justin does his things with the billion-dollar billionaires in the private club. I'll do a kitchen party, and I'll come and sing some songs, and we'll pass the hat, and that's how I'm going to pay for the trip.
Well, it's long been a Newfoundland ritual, as you know, to sing for votes. Hand out a bit of rum while you're at it, too. Anyway, great to have you on, Charlie Angus. Good luck with your campaign. You're a fan favorite here on VOCM and in Newfoundland and Labrador. Thanks for making the time today.
Oh, that was a lot of fun. We'll see you soon. Take care.
The Tim Powers Show will be right back. This is the Tim Powers Show on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Well, maybe if we're unaware that winter has ended in Newfoundland and it's a good time to move home. Apparently there wasn't any snow, there was no fog banks, there were no delays, there was none of those things. Of course I'm being sarcastic, but I'm doing it deliberately because I know my next guest can handle it, and that's the Minister of Advanced Education, Skills, Labour, and Minister for Responsible for Immigration and Multiculturalism, Jerry Byrne. Jerry, good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me on the show, Tim. Really much appreciated.
Well, you last week launched an immigration strategy, and part of the strategy's purpose is to grow the province's immigration by 50% in the next 5 years. And you've made the bold argument, and you're no stranger to bold arguments, that it is the best time to move to Newfoundland. Why is that?
Well, let's cut to the chase, Tim, and let's really get to where I think your listeners want to go, where I want to go. We are facing some economic challenges. Our unemployment rates are up. Why are you doing this at this point in time? How's that for beating?
There, good. You can have this seat when you're retired. You're doing well.
There you go. Well, you know what? Listen, the bottom line here is that even in an economy, which in some sectors is challenging, we have other sectors of our Newfoundland and Labrador economy which are growing very quickly. And we made the announcement last week at Verafin, which is a IT company,
yep,
which is hiring Newfoundlander and Labradorians on a weekly, if not daily, basis to join their ranks. They're also recruiting talent from overseas and from students, international students studying at MUN. They're recruiting them after their studies are completed to stay in the province. So let's cut to the chase and let's get right down to this. Are there opportunities in Newfoundland and Labrador despite some of the economic uncertainties? Absolutely there are. And that's where our immigration strategy needs to go. We've got some demographic challenges in Newfoundland and Labrador. Our population is older, and we are growing less in numbers. Yeah. That's the bottom line. So we got to fix this. We got to do whatever we possibly can to fairly and honestly and sincerely fix it. First and foremost, let me be very clear to everyone, myself included. Our first priority is to train Newfoundlanders and Labradorians for the jobs that exist. That's why we have a $130 million a year jobs training program for our province called the Labor Market Development Agreement. We have another agreement called the Canada Newfoundland and Labrador Job Fund, which is a almost $8 million job training fund. So where there are jobs, we will always look to Newfoundlanders and Labradorians first to fill those jobs with the skills that they have. We will train them wherever we can to fill those jobs. And we will ensure that before any employer looks to outside to fill a job, they must first prove to us and to everyone that they advertised for the job, they posted it for not a period of days, not a period of weeks, but a period of months, and could not fill the jobs at home. What kind of jobs are we looking at? We're looking at higher skill jobs, jobs in the health professions, jobs in engineering, jobs in IT, jobs in a whole bunch of professions that currently are not being filled in Newfoundland and Labrador.
Let me pick up on two points there, because you knew I was going to ask that question, and that is, are we culturally mature enough to deal with an aggressive immigration strategy? And I ask that because you've seen the stories. You're in a key portfolio in the government of Newfoundland, stories saying, no, I don't want more temporary foreign workers coming back. I wanted those jobs protected. You've articulated a particular path whereby Newfoundlanders should be given the first opportunity. But is there more that needs to be done? Because there does still seem to be a little bit of a protectionist mentality that floats about the province, that newcomers aren't welcome if they're going to threaten our way of life. And certainly you watch it as well as I do. That's a dialogue that world leaders are wrongly pushing in different places.
Tim, that's a question of leadership, and that's where leadership and leaders have to step in. We've got a lot of great leadership in Newfoundland and Labrador, coming not only from the Association for New Canadians, from companies that are willingly and, you know, just readily embracing not only Newfoundland and Labradorians, but outside talent to sort of bulk up and make the perspective even fresher. But this is where you need political leadership as well. We have in Newfoundland and Labrador the most welcoming culture anywhere, and we should be praising it and exalting it. We do need a little bit of extra work to make sure that those that would like to suggest that immigration and immigrants bring us down or make us less, we need to really, really engage them. And instead of getting into an insulting tit-for-tat argument with each other, what we really need to do is prove out that everywhere immigration has occurred, it has actually provided jobs, not costed jobs. 50% of, in many North American jurisdictions, 50% of the new entrepreneurs, 50% of the new businesses that are growing up are growing as a result of immigrants who are bringing new, fresh ideas to the economy. Yeah. And they're actually employing people in the local labor market, including here in Newfoundland and Labrador. You know, I could recount.
And we all can. I don't mean to cut you off, but I mean, we always seem to forget. We all came to Newfoundland and Labrador. I stayed in Newfoundland and Labrador. We were all immigrants at one point as well. It may have been a little bit longer, but that is, in fact, what happened. But let me get to the other part of the question I want to ask you when you talked about Newfoundland businesses advertising. So I understand you need to do that. How burdensome, though, is that going to be on the particular business? Because you got to strike a fine line, as you well know, between making sure that the opportunity is given to those who are there, but also not being protectionist. So what does that look like?
Well, the burden is the truth. Listen, if a job can be filled in Newfoundland and Labrador by a Newfoundland and Labrador, they're not going to, you know, they're not going to be able to participate. And be able to draw down on a new arrival to be able to fill that job. So if that's a burden, so be it. It's a burden, but it's not a burden. What employers have to do is they have to advertise their vacancies, their positions that are available for all to see, plain and clear, and then. When it is established that they cannot fill those positions, that they can then, that's part of the process of applying for a nominee, what we call a provincial nominee.
Yeah, okay.
And we move forward. Now, where is the burden? And this is what I identified. Sometimes it's all the paperwork that has to be processed to get there. It's been a real sort of, it's not been an easy process. Call a spade a shovel. It has not been an easy process. So that's why I've, as part of the strategy, we took two staff members, two jobs from within my department that were doing a particular function, a job that we moved them into the immigration branch to bulk up on the resources that are within our immigration section. So no new money, but at the same time, just more efficient money. Okay. And we've provided more resources to employers to be able to help them get this paperwork through. And that I think has been, when we conducted our consultations, Tim, as to how this gets done, that was a real big item that people wanted action on.
How do we
fine and well for us to do all this work, but you got a role to play too, government.
Yeah, no kidding. How do you keep people? Because as you know, the APEC report says 40% of immigrants shows only 40% of immigrants remained in Newfoundland and Labrador 10 years after moving here. You talked about demography and declining birth rates and the like, but if we're welcoming people as we should be, I firmly believe that. How do we keep them in Newfoundland and Labrador?
Two things. First and foremost, most important thing, the way you attract newcomers, the way you retain newcomers, a job. You know, it's the same. It's no different than anybody else. It is the key component to a successful integration, a newcomer strategy, an immigration strategy, and that's why it has to be built in that before anyone can nominate for a position to be able to come, if anybody, an employer wants to nominate someone to come into Newfoundland and Labrador through our provincial nominee program, there has to be a solid, steady job offer that they are committed to. If they can't offer a job, then there is no nomination. So first and foremost, to attract, it's a job. And if you do have a job, it's no different than anybody else. If you do have a job, you're far, far, far more likely to stick around. The second element of this, Tim, and this is where the education, this is where the leadership comes in, building a multicultural society. And it starts in the schools. So part of our strategy is we are a very, very give it open society and culture in Newfoundland and Labrador. Enforcing that, just building on that, just reinforcing that is what I meant to say. Reinforcing that is just having an awareness of the difference of cultures, but the similarities of cultures, and that's we're starting with right in our school system.
Before I let you go, in the minute or so that we have left, one of the elements you've talked about in this plan is trying to get people, Newfoundlanders and Labradorians who live away to come home, and you've talked about enticing them back. In that minute that you have, Jerry, how do you do that, and what does an enticement look like?
Tim, this is the soft sell. You know, there's been a fair bit of, you know, attention to this particular element to it. But let me say, I understand, you understand, everyone understands. A Newfoundland and Labradorian by birth, a Newfoundland and Labradorian by family, knows about Newfoundland and Labrador. We don't need multi-million-dollar marketing campaigns. We don't need a whole lot of energy spent and a whole lot of money trying to get people to come back home. But what we do need, we need to stay connected to Newfoundlanders and Labradorians, because expats, expatriates that are working in Alberta or Ontario or in Washington, D.C. or California or wherever, what they need to know is or have access to is a reasonable source of information of new opportunities. Since we launched the strategy, I have been literally near bombarded with emails from people saying, listen, I'm in Alberta. I have retired or I'm about to retire. I do have funds. I intend to retire back home. Can you connect me? I'm really interested in investing in the tourism industry, or I'm really invested in taking my skills and my trade that I developed in Alberta or Ontario or elsewhere, I'm really interested in making the go of that back home, not necessarily as a 500-person business, but my wife and I, my spouse and I, we're interested in starting a small business back home. And you know what? Those are the kinds of things, when you keep in touch, when you supply a steady pipeline of information, that's how you'll get expats. No glossy incentives. Any Newfoundlander and Labradorian who wants to come back home, they're eligible for the $130 million in programming that I spoke of, you know, earlier. It's different than a new Canadian or a new immigrant to Canada. You have access to the programs that are available to each and every one of us. That's the best enticement.
Well, good articulation of the strategy. Certainly, it's one that is needed. It's a nonpartisan thing, in my view. The more we can all do to help grow Newfoundland by bringing in new people is important and vital. Good to have you on the show today. Terry Byrne, thanks very much.
Tim, really appreciate it. We'll talk soon again, I hope.
The Tim Powers Show will be right back. This is the Tim Powers Show on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Well, last week, the all-party committee that had been studying mental health and addictions in the province came forward with their recommendations. They made 54 of them in their report called Towards Recovery. It's an important report. It's an important issue. It's always been an important issue to me for a whole variety of reasons, and it is for my next guest. And with me, I have Dr. Janine Hubbard, who's the president. Now, take a deep breath. I'll read the full name of the Association of Psychology Newfoundland and Labrador. Now, I don't need CBT for getting that out, Janine. But what did you think of the report? Now that it's out, a lot of hard work went into it. What are your initial thoughts?
Well, I'm really pleased that it did see the light of day. We first presented to this committee nearly 2 years ago. So I know that it's gone through a lot of time and a change in government. So I give them a lot of credit for all three parties continuing to persist with it. I would say it's very inclusive. I'd also say it's very ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
There are some very attainable goals and there are some very aspirational goals in there.
Well, before we get to those, let me just tell the audience what the health minister said. He basically summed up his response into three areas. He wanted to move mental health away from the shadows. He said that we need to move mental health care out of institutions and into the community. And the third part, we need to put some money into the system to do it. So on your scale of aspirational versus achievable versus ambitious, where does the money part fit first? Because so much of what the government can actually do is dependent on what they actually spend.
Absolutely. Well, we're really encouraged because at the moment, mental health encompasses about 5.7% of the Newfoundland and Labrador health budget, and this would take it up to approximately 9%. That's far more consistent with the percentage that we've been advocating for years. That's consistent with many other Commonwealth countries, such as the UK. That's always been sort of the benchmark, is around 9% of healthcare spending.
Any idea what that, can I just ask you a quick question off that? Any idea yet, I mean, I realize the report only came out last week, but what that spending might actually look like? Have you gotten any suggestion from the government or any recommendation as to what that might appear like?
I think it's going to be multifaceted for sure. I think there's a few quick fixes that are going to come along, and then there's going to be some major institutional things. I mean, two of the recommendations that came out were basically rebuilding Her Majesty's Penitentiary and rebuilding the Waterford, looking different than they do currently, but some major infrastructure. One of the things that I think is helping to boost this, and the timing of this has worked really well, is that Newfoundland and Labrador signed on to the health accord with the federal government, which is finally actually giving the province a percentage of money that is targeted and must be targeted towards mental health.
And that's a key thing. Every province is arguing for this, and I think we can all make the argument there's never enough money that is actually being spent on mental health, but the public opinion climate is such now that more is being spent and people understand why that is happening. What you talked earlier, what are some of those ambitious targets that you worry about the government perhaps being challenged to make from this particular report?
Well, I'm encouraged by the idea of decreasing wait times, because at the moment, absolutely, people are waiting 18 months, 2 years to try to get in to see a psychologist, for example. And we know that that's not acceptable or sustainable on a long-term basis. The concern I would have is making sure that in committing to decreasing wait times, they're making sure that people are accessing appropriate services. For example, one of the recommendations are some single session models. Mm-hmm. Single sessions can be wonderful for some people. That may be all that they need, but I want to make sure that those who need more intensive treatments are also being offered those more intensive treatments. And also at the same time, making sure that there is an increase in personnel, because we want to make sure that we're not just increasing the workload of existing staff. I do credit them for acknowledging that they want to address issues of compassion fatigue and burnout in the existing staff in the province. So I give them credit for that.
What about this notion? Is this one of the quick targets that can be achieved? And Dr. Hagee highlighted this, moving the current mental health services prison system provision from justice and public safety to health and community services. Is that a good thing?
Again, I think, as unfortunately, like a lot of these things, it's going to come out in the wash when we see the details. They've promised us a much more detailed report coming out in June, outlining some of the more specifics. So I think I'm going to have to defer comment on that one until we see the plan in June.
What isn't here that you wish was here? And that's not to take away from the good work that's being done, but was there something glaring that was missed, or something important that you think that also needs to be kept in this discussion as the government focuses on how it will address mental health provision in Newfoundland and Labrador?
I think they have done an excellent job of keeping it very comprehensive. They've tried to work to address some of the underpinnings as well, including things like looking at poverty, looking at still shelter and housing. Those are going to be some important things. The one thing that I'm hoping will be addressed, it's not addressed directly at the moment, is early assessment and early intervention, partly because it's a topic near and dear to my own heart clinically. But we have all kinds of discussions about being able to offer services, but we need to make sure that individuals are getting the right services. So we want to make sure that there is a thorough assessment happening early on to make sure that they're being referred for the appropriate treatment.
Now, one of the things that I find fascinating in the psychology profession, which may have not been the case when you started doing your graduate work and working in the field, but is becoming abundantly clear, is psychologists, psychiatrists, other mental health workers are also having to become public advocates. And I make that comment having read a comment this past week from Emily Curran, who has been a major healthcare and mental health advocate, and has said that this is all well and good, but we have to keep pushing here. We have to keep on top of it because government's priorities change, healthcare priorities change. In your role, how much of your work now is about advocacy, and how important is ongoing advocacy?
You're absolutely right. There was absolutely no part of my graduate training that trained me how to become an advocate, although we're certainly now including that as part of our graduate curriculum for some of our psychology residents. If nothing else, we give them a seminar once a year talking about advocacy, so we're getting it in there a little bit. I think it is going to be very important to continue to monitor where this is going with the government. They've promised us some timelines. They've promised some accountability. But I do think it's going to be really important for groups such as APNL and all of the other advocacy groups in the province to continue to keep monitoring this so it doesn't wind up another study that winds up on a shelf.
Now, often with advocacy groups, and having worked and continue to work in this industry, I know you're often stronger when you're together, and what governments will try and do sometimes strategically and tactically is to split governments apart. Is there a unity of purpose among the variety of different groups that have contributed to this report and will keep a spotlight on the government?
That's certainly the sense that I've been getting. I was at the release on Friday there, and certainly talking to a number of my colleagues in the room, I think there's a real, I would describe it as cautious optimism in terms of where we go from here. But again, I think there's a lot of let's see the details. I think there's a lot of us waiting for June, waiting to see some of the specifics.
What does success look like for you in 5 years or 10 years from now if this report is picked up? What does our mental health and wellness system in Newfoundland and Labrador look like if people have acted to the extent that the intentions of today suggest they will?
Oh, really good comment, because this has been one of the difficulties in trying to advocate for mental health services is because you don't see the payoff immediately.
Yeah.
Reason why governments have often struggled, because you don't see the payoff during their political term. You're going to see the payoff 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now. So that piece is going to be difficult. My goal would be seeing individuals getting the right service as quickly as is needed for them. And that is going to look very different. Sometimes, yes, it's going to be coming in and chatting with me as a psychologist. Sometimes it might be having access to an online intervention. In some cases, it may require hospitalization. We need to make sure that we have the full range of services available with the minimal wait time possible.
Now, just before I let you go, how are your peers feeling? Are they feeling, you talked about burnout earlier, and this question is, do we have enough trained professionals in this field of service? I know in Ontario, where I am today, there's a shortage, and in just about every province, there's a shortage of psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers. I assume that's generally true in Newfoundland, is it?
That is indeed. I will say that's one area that Newfoundland and Labrador has made real strides in the last few years. I have to give a lot of credit. MUN has developed the first English language PsyD program. That's a doctorate in clinical psychology. So for the first time, we are training our own in-house doctorate level clinical psychologists, which has made a huge difference. That, and we have increased the number of residency spots here in the province so that we're even attracting psychologists, budding psychologists from other provinces who come and finish off their training with us and decide to stay. So we're making some gains here, but absolutely we need a whole lot more.
Well, as somebody who entered the mental health and wellness system 20-odd years ago, I can attest to lots of progress being made. There's lots more to be done, but well done by you and many other advocates who continue to push for that. A system is never perfect. We have to stay on top of it all. Great to have you with us today, Dr. Janine Hubbard. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
The Tim Powers Show will be right back. This is the Tim Powers Show on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Well, if you saw last week's federal budget or heard it or even listened to this program when I spoke to David Akin, you would have heard the word innovation a lot. You would have heard about automation, and you would have heard about disruption. How do all of these things come together? And are we as Canadians prepared, and are our governments doing the right things to create the policy conditions for innovation, to embrace automation and to deal with disruption? Somebody who's been talking about this for a very long time and is well regarded around the world is Madras Gala, who is the CEO of Blue Drop Learning Limited in St. John's, Newfoundland. Ahmad, great to have you on. What were your initial reactions when you saw the federal budget last week?
Oh, thanks, Tim. I was very encouraged, actually, because we are, as you said, living through a period of massive disruption. I think this is the fourth stage of an industrial revolution. So they're calling it, you know, Industrial Revolution 4.0, and it's by far the biggest, much bigger than the movement to steam engines and combustion engines and so on. So we have to do something. And while, you know, in the U.S. they're gone protectionist and they're basically trying to, you know, fight to keep jobs that are disappearing, I think Canada is really saying we're going to make a big move towards preparing people for what's actually going to happen. And that's infinitely a more sensible route to go.
And what is going to happen? You speak on this a lot. I've seen lots of data, some of which includes 50% will be working in the gig economy by 2020. Today's average worker has 15 to 20 jobs over their working lives. 40% of existing Canadian jobs could disappear in the next decade due to automation. Is that all accurate in your view, Ahmad? Or is that a bit of fear-mongering? Or is that simply saying, hey, we have to be ready for this?
No, it is. I think it is. I mean, the timing, no one can call. But in terms of this kind of disruption, I think it's actually the reason for the election south of the border, and it's the reason for Brexit. I mean, if you look at the statistics, unemployment is actually not that high. But there is a, I think there's an anxiety in middle-skill America, Canada, and most of the industrialized world. It's not caused by trade. It's caused by automation. And, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, this has happened before. 200 years ago, 80% of people worked in agriculture. Today, 2% of people work in agriculture. So it's a natural part of the evolution of an economy. This one is a little bit more disruptive because we're getting to the point now where people are wondering, well, what's going to be left for human beings to do? But whether that's as dramatic as that or not, there's no question that every time that this has happened in our history as the human race, there's been massive disruption. There have been winners and losers. There's a polarization in the income gap. Some people do very, very well. A lot of the general population don't. And historically, there's always been a solution, like unions and workers' rights and democracy in general have sort of tilted the equation in the earlier industrial revolutions. And I think we're facing now a need for another tilt. Otherwise, there's going to be a bit of a mess to clean up.
So with that tilt, what do people need? You are in the learning business. You have been a pioneer in this particular business. I know you often talk about lifelong skills, credentials. What does the menu of options look like for somebody who wants to embrace as opposed to be steamrolled by all of the change we're about to encounter?
Well, I would read Thomas Friedman's new book, for one, which is, don't know the title exactly, but it's about the age of accelerations. And basically, what he's putting out there is that, every 4 years, people will have to completely redone their skill set. I don't think we're there yet. A lot of people might be listening and saying, well, I can't see that in my job. But just in general, if you look at the skills that people are picking up on the job and through training and just informally through working, there is really a massive constant learning that's going on. And, you know, I graduated as a mechanical engineer, and I stupidly or smartly started my first business before I graduated. Within 4 years, I mean, I kind of knew that if I don't make this business work, I'm in trouble. I can't go back and work as a mechanical engineer, or it'll be very hard for me to get back in because the world is just constantly changing. So lifelong skills development is critical, and I think people have to realize that your relevance today in the workforce is no longer a destination. It's a journey.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole idea of relevance before, a generation or two ago, I will get X piece of paper, X credential. It could be high school, it could be university, and I'm relevant. That is my ticket to relevance. Today, that's just a starting point. And I think that major shift in mindset is critical. And that's why I was encouraged by the focus on skills and innovation in the budget, because that's really, I think it was a visionary acknowledgement of what's happening. And people can either bury their heads in the sand as individuals or as a government. We could bury our heads in the sand, or we can just take it on, head on.
But one thing about that, I agree. I think, look, one thing the Trudeau government has been very good at is about talking about the future and creating the right movement for an enthusiastic embrace of the future. How, though, would you advise them to deal with the bureaucratic inertia that resists change that they're going to have to deal with? Because as you well know, you've worked around the world, you've dealt with different governmental jurisdictions. There is the political will, the appetite, and the momentum that comes from that. Then there's the actual doing that requires people who could be displaced to make changes. So what would you counsel on approach to the government as they deal with that?
I think you're much more qualified to counsel government than me, but I will say just a couple of observations from dealing with governments. First of all, I think today there has to be an acknowledgement at the leadership level that not taking a risk is the greatest risk you can take today. With the pace of change and the way that things are changing, standing still is absolutely the most dangerous thing. Running government by default instead of by design is the most dangerous thing that we could be doing in society. So it absolutely starts with the top. And, you know, I'm apolitical, but I'm just a big fan of what I've seen recently. And even in places like Newfoundland, I mean, we have the Way Forward document. Obviously, we're having some challenges here in my home province where I'm based. And I thought that was a visionary document to say we need to do things differently, and we need to get out of our sort of silo mindset and our default approach to running government. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if we don't get national champions, if we don't get our share of the Googles and the Facebooks and so on that are setting up, we'll have no money to do any of this. So whatever the solutions are, because there are going to be winners and losers. There's been winners and losers.
That's life, yeah.
Every single industrial revolution that's happened has totally disrupted, caused a lot of pain and a lot of joy, depending on what side you ended up on. So if that's the case, then we have to have the fiscal capacity to do things, which means that we have to have companies that are generating revenue, that are succeeding on the national stage. And if I could just use an example that we've had, which is something I never actually thought I would ever be promoting, but strategic procurement from government. Every innovative economy, innovation is not the same as sort of manufacturing, where there's a lot of arguments to be made, like just stay out of the way, create the conditions and get out of the way. Innovation does require government policy, industrial policy. I really believe that. Everything from IP to picking your national champions. I mean, the U.S. has a set-aside policy for federal procurement, and they're the largest customer of anything in the world is the U.S. government, where they'll only give a certain percentage of their contracts to small companies to help them to grow and to be big companies. So there's an active involvement in the marketplace to build national champions. Our whole aerospace industry, which we're a beneficiary of.
Yeah, fair point.
It was, you know, if not for the money for CAE and Bombardier in their day, we wouldn't be the fourth or fifth largest aerospace industry in the world. So I do think that there is a role for government policy. And the example for us is a few years ago, we were just getting into this workforce space back around 2010, 2009. We had a product that was really for businesses to learn and individuals to learn. And we realized that learning, unfortunately, is like, you know, fitness or eating the right food. It doesn't go viral. So we were wondering, well, who has an interest in this? And we realized the governments do. And I have never, usually we had an office in California.
Right.
A couple of companies we spun out years ago still have an office over there. And so usually when we had a big idea, we would go to California. Because what worked over there is you could be the first. No one else has this. You want to do this first. And what worked in Canada was don't be the last. Everybody else has this. You don't want to be left behind. But we actually went to the Newfoundland government, they actually took this on to develop skills for the workforce here using online learning and bringing that value that we thought customers would pay for, like small businesses, directly to them and made it free of charge. I think there's been 47,000 online courses done.
Is that right? Wow.
In Newfoundland, yeah. It was and we have, I think, 30,000 registered users on the system. So that little strategic procurement, it was a big risk back then because I don't think it's been tried actually in most of the world. You know, we've created 40 jobs based on that investment. It was only $1.5 million, I think, the initial one. So we created 40 jobs. We sold that now in 7 or 8 countries around the world.
And this is your workforce super system. This is the
yeah,
model.
That's where it started. It actually started 7 years ago from Newfoundland buying this little, it was called SmartForce NL, and it was a really visionary thing for them to do at the time, much more risky than the stuff we're doing today because we hadn't tried anything in that space. And we've now taken that. We just have a large implementation now in Los Angeles for the workforce system in L.A. County, the second largest city over there. So we have taken that concept and we've been building and building on it as workforce super systems because, you know, the idea that your business, your place of work, is now going to be the gatekeeper for your skills training and is going to help you to track that, and then you're going to store your records in that business, is arsenine. I mean, it's a totally outdated notion. You're only there for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then you move on. So the idea that people take their credentials for life, that they have access to skills on demand, and that they can take it to their employer versus their employer being the gatekeeper of that, I think that that's the transition, and that's where, you know, in our case, Blue Drop Innovation, that's where our technology is really unique in the world, and we got that start from government procurement in Newfoundland.
Well, you have a skill of telling a good story, and it's an important one, and I hope our listeners pay heed to it, because as we both know, we were both around at the time when the cod moratorium came in. Your company came forward after that. You can thrive. You can survive. Disruption is real, but people are very able to manage it, as you've historically pointed out. Great to have you on today, Ahmad Rascala. Thank you for your time, and we look forward to hearing more of you on this particular topic.
The Tim Powers Show will return in a moment on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network. This is the Tim Powers Show on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Well, I opened the weekend paper last week and saw a story about a tool library. And I'm sure as many others who opened the paper and saw they were scratching their head wondering what a tool library is. My name may be Tim, but I'm no tool man. But our next guy is the executive director of the tool library, St. John's Tool Library, Ian Froud. Ian, you must get that reaction, though, do you? What is a tool library, and how did it come about? How do people react? And then tell us a little bit about the library.
I think a lot of the initial reaction is, it makes so much sense. Why didn't we have one already? But the way it works is just like you'd have a book library. You'd walk in to the tool library, and if you need a circular saw or a reciprocating saw or a hammer, come in, get your membership, and book out the tool, and you go off on your merry way.
Now, you used to work in politics. Some might say you've traded one set of tools for another. Patty Daly would definitely say that. He'll like that line when he hears our interview. But how come we never had one in St. John's before? And what made you decide to pick up the toolkit here and pull it all together?
Well, I needed a set of tools to do a project, and I borrowed from friends and family. But not everyone has friends and family to reach out to. With the tools you'd need to do a project in your home or your backyard. So I thought, well, okay, so I can do this, but not many people have access to that. So how do we make that happen for more people? There's one, I was up to Toronto early last year and visited the one on the Danforth and made the decision to make it happen in St. John's. I wanted us to have access to that great resource, to be able to save a few dollars on projects we want to do around our home or garden, and decided to make it happen from there. So began to bring together a group of people, raised some money, got some many donations from a very generous public through a crowdfunding campaign. And I spent many hours driving around the city picking up tool donations. People call me up, and I go and pick up a couple hundred dollars worth of tools from their house. It's quite strange to do at the beginning, to be completely honest.
Well, I imagine it is, but good on you. So did you look at other models? You mentioned the Danforth, up in the Danforth. Were there other tool libraries across the country or elsewhere that you looked at to model what you're doing in St. John's?
Yeah, there's about 20 in Canada now, actually.
Really?
It's about four or five of those started up in the last year, so it's picking up a bit of steam. We decided to set up as a nonprofit so that we'd be as accessible to people as possible. So our membership fees are able to stay at a reasonable rate, starting at $50 a year. Most of them are nonprofits, and decided to do that so it would be accessible versus, or as compared to, a for-profit model of tool rental. And of course, we have those around as well, and those serve a purpose as well.
So I see you got about 70 memberships sold now, and as you said, your membership range from 50 to 150. Who's the sort of person that is joining? Is it, as you described, somebody in your circumstance where you were looking to do a job, you didn't have the tools yourself, instead of necessarily paying for one tool that you may never use again, people go to a pooling or a library service. Is that the sort of member who's coming on board for this now?
Yeah, that's for the most part who's interested. It's actually quite diverse, though. We have people... we have nonprofits, so we have a community garden that's signed up. So they want access to a larger set of tools than they would be able to afford as a nonprofit, to do projects that they'd only do relatively infrequently. So we've had nonprofits sign up. I'm talking to some small businesses, potential for them signing up as well, because you're doing, if you're starting a business, starting a business costs a fortune anyways in most circumstances, and there's to any way we can reduce that cost, encourage businesses to start up, I think would be great. So we want to provide that service to them as well. So there's some of them that are considering joining. And then within individuals joining, there's quite a bit of diversity. So people that are hobbyist carpenters who might want a specialist tool that don't necessarily have that particular tool. Individuals who are very new to doing anything around their home or garden who don't necessarily want to buy the tool because, well, I might not actually enjoy doing this. I might not be very good at it, but want to try. So we get quite a few like that as well. And it's been interesting. It's split. It's been great. It's split about 50-50 male female, which is really, really great because it makes for a diverse community that we're building. And that's a part of what I'm trying to achieve with this as well is a community around it so that people can learn from one another, learn skills and connections across our community.
You make an excellent point there because people will remember in last year's provincial budget when traditional libraries were on the chopping block, there was a lot of outcry because people view them, as you were describing them, centers of community gathering and community activity. And it seems like this is where you're trying to go here. How do you make it or self-sustaining? Is it through the memberships? I see you're aiming to get 1,200 members or hope to get 1,200 members by the end of the second year. How does this stay and continue forward?
Well, we've been able to start out through a few grants that we've received and people's generous donations, but the intent is to behave like a social enterprise. So we have a community purpose. But we don't want to be dependent upon grants and donations. We want it to be dependent upon providing a useful service to individuals, and people willing to pay for that service. So we are completely volunteer driven at this point. So we have no staffing costs. But as we grow, that might be necessary, as we might want to open 4 additional hours because we're open a pretty narrow set of hours right now. But our intent is to be self-sustaining. We can do that at this scale with about 300, 350 members.
Okay.
Like to cover costs and be able to invest in repairing tools and purchasing tools that are higher in demand. But to be able to grow and build our inventory, we'll need more members than that.
The other thing that I found interesting about the stories that have been done on this are the people that are volunteering and getting engaged. So are you seeing tradespeople come in wanting to share their craft? Who are the typical volunteers, and how much of sharing of craft do you actually have occurring?
And we're hoping for more of that. So we have a number of tradespeople who are helping staff the space or helping repair tools, for instance. Because we have to do that on an ongoing basis. We actually need more tradespeople to work with us because we want to have someone there at all times who can coach people through tool use and how to build a bookshelf or how to replace your toilet or whatever the case may be if people want to be brave and do that sort of task. But a large portion of the volunteers to date, I've been very thankful for it, is couple blocks actually. One is people that are from away who've moved here, and second are university students through the Student Volunteer Bureau on campus. People want regular hours of volunteering to go in tandem with the university program they have, or to diversify their university experience. So we've been lucky to have a bunch of those individuals.
Now, I hope it's a user-friendly environment and you ban those terrible Allen keys. Do you ever run screaming away from boxes whenever I see an Allen key? I'm sure I'm not alone on that. And I have my tool library is a guy named Ben. He's my brother-in-law. He does all my work. But I'm useless in this arena and many others, I suspect people would agree. But I find it interesting, though. We're having this discussion right now in a week or so after a federal budget where innovation has been talked about and disruption in the workforce. And that brings you to connect to something like a tool library where a lot of the skills that people have now, people are saying may not be relevant, though I would disagree with that going forward. Do you think it's kind of there's some irony in you doing this now as the world's all about automation and you're going back to hand tools?
Well, I think people are appreciating their own skill set. So ability to do things, the ability to do things for themselves and that resilience. I think people are feeling the need to be more self-reliant, as in particular as costs go up. So their taxes, the HST went up here last year, as fees and that sort of thing goes up. So our disposable income comes down. So we have to get creative about how we do things for ourselves and how we engage with our community, and how to cut money out of our household budget. So I think people are engaging in that way. So there's the wanting to be self-reliant, and be creative with your own skills and build things in your house and the pride that comes with that. But there's also the, I got to knock off X number of dollars from my budget every month because that's being taken from me through additional taxes or fees or whatever the case may be. So people are going to have, or people are being creative in that way.
Another...
And then there's the growth of the sharing economy.
Yeah.
And we're a part of that.
Yeah, that's true.
With cars and all sorts.
Well, and you don't have to worry about Ubers in Newfoundland and now paying that HST, of course. And another era, people might call that being crafty Newfoundland or figuring out how to save a few bucks. Now, before I let you go, in about the 30 seconds we have left, your commitment to the community continues. You're looking to run for council. Tell us about what motivated that and where you're running.
I am running for St. John's City Council and running in Ward 4. And I'm running for very similar reasons why I started the tool library. I believe our community should have fantastic services that make our lives and our neighborhoods better and healthier and a community more resilient. And I want to bring that approach to that approach and that drive to City Hall.
Well, best of luck to you. Engaging in the community as you have, I'm sure, will bode well. You're also a younger man, and new, young, energetic leadership is never a bad thing. We wish you lots of luck, Ian. Thanks for making the time today.
Great. Thanks for having me, Tim.
The Tim Powers Show will be right back. This is the Tim Powers Show on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Well, Kevin O'Leary found Newfoundland last week. He appeared in St. John's and I believe even in Gander. Last time he went, I think it might have been with me. We sat on a plane together, although we weren't together, and he was there for a presentation. But Mr. O'Leary's presence in Newfoundland perhaps has more people scratching their head and wondering than it does saluting and cheering. And one guy who wrote a fascinating column, I thought, about Mr. O'Leary's visit is Russell Wangerski, who's the Atlantic Regional columnist for TC Media. And the title of his column, A Conservative Wolf in Sealskin Clothes. I love that. I know you're not the headline writer, but you like that headline?
I did indeed. I did indeed. It came from Pam Frampton. My column.
Well, good on Pam. She nailed it. You've written about Kevin a few times, Russell. What is it about him that seems to get your goat? And I think we share that. But what was it about this trip in particular?
Well, I think there's two things that get my goat about him, to be honest. One is his complete sort of lack of a grasp of anything to do with federal politics. Mm-hmm. Or constitutional law, and the other is that he seems sort of like a disinterested candidate. He's here, but he's not here. Mm-hmm. And often his suggestions are of what he'd like to do are things that don't need doing or shouldn't be done.
Yeah, he, I agree with you on the disconnect. He was on this program before Christmas, and he talked about, well, how would he deal with with oil development? He would have referendums. He offers an awful simplistic menu that's discongruent with most of the way things work in this country. But you talk about in your column the simple prop populism. Do you think it can work for O'Leary with the Conservative Party and in Canada?
I don't know. I mean, I was referring that particularly to his putting on a sealskin coat when he was here. And later on, I found out that he did pretty much the same thing with a cowboy hat in a visit to Alberta. And you know, I'm really concerned that what he wants to do, what he talks about doing, is a bunch of business buzzwords that actually have incredible ramifications for the average working person here in the country. I mean, you can talk all you want about wanting to reduce regulation, but you better have a pretty good idea of what reducing regulation means if you're going to vote for it. You know, because it can mean worse working conditions, it can mean worse environmental conditions, it can mean a whole host of things that sound nice as a sort of a buzzword delivery. Oh, we're going to, you know, everything's going to be simpler and more straightforward for small business owners. Well, let's keep the whole argument in context.
Yeah, about the context, and it's a key point. In your column, you speak about the buzzwords, as you rightly point out, and some of the changes he's talking about, and you talk about, well, what if you were to change the way, for example, flags of convenience were dealt with? What would that mean to Canadian guidelines and working people? Or if you change the way coal mining worked in Cape Breton because you were simply racing to the bottom? Why do you think, though, he has an audience? This is the part that confounds me, because I have spent time with him on television. I have seen him in different settings. He is trained by Don Cherry and has a very similar approach, I think, in terms of communication style, and that works for Mr. Cherry, but he's not running to be the Prime Minister of Canada. So with that long preamble, why do you think he's connecting? Because he is at some level.
Well, I think he's connecting because on the first most basic point, just simple, straightforward name recognition. You know, you say Kevin O'Leary, you talk about Dragon's Den or Shark Tank, people know who you're talking about. And you go, oh, it's that guy. That has had an awful lot of traction in recent elections, some south of the border. You know, I think it's a real danger that a number of people in the voting populace no longer bother to go any further than do I recognize this guy's name or this person's name? But I think that's a big part of his traction. And also there's the sort of the thud and bluster. We're going to shake this up. It's going to be more businesslike. We're going to, you know, I can do business, so I can do this, which, you know, you could argue so far hasn't panned out quite the way American voters expected it would in the United States.
No, I think that's a very fair point. Although O'Leary seems to be a bit more sensible in his broader communications fights. He's not on Twitter simply looking to irritate others, and he hasn't picked a fight yet with the mainstream media, because that, as you alluded to, is the body in large measure that's empowered him to have this particular brand. Where do you think his campaign goes from here? Because the criticisms you're making, which are legitimate, are being made by his fellow competitors in the race. They're being made by national columnists. Is he just going to pay no heed to them based on what you've seen and just drive through on spin and bluster? Or might he look to course correct? Or do you think he feels he has to?
I don't think he feels he has to. I think he kind of feels like he's in the lead and likely to stay that way. And it's a fascinating thing to think that someone could be leading in the run for the Conservative Party while espousing a group of ideas that are sometimes conservative and sometimes not so much conservative, sometimes not conservative at all. But again, you know, this is the same guy who can say with a straight face, what needs to be done is I need to energize the young across Canada. The party isn't doing that. I can bring people out from colleges and universities. Yeah. I can bring them out, except not to my rallies. he had a mere handful of people younger than 50 at his event here in St. John's. So if he's going to attract them, unless it's with pints of beer, I don't see it happening.
And no candidate's ever done that before, of course, ever.
No, ever.
What's interesting, though, is O'Leary does promote himself as being the person who can bring millennials over from the Liberal Party and the New Democrats to the Conservative Party. One question related to all of this, you talked about the audience that was there in St. John's. I think he's had a either an average or a slightly bigger average audience than conservative candidates that have been there thus far. The Conservative Party, I think, as we would all agree federally in Newfoundland and Labrador, is still, to be diplomatic, in a rebuilding phase, maybe still on life support with one eye open. But what is it about the people that are supporting O'Leary in Newfoundland and Labrador, do you think, that allows them to embrace this? Many of them are former politicians who would know better and know how the system works. Why would they be glomming onto O'Leary, in your view?
I'm not sure that anyone was necessarily glomming onto him at his event here at the St. John's event, because I think there was a healthy sort of body of people who were there to kick the tires, I think. Much as the way John Crosby had said, he was there to see what this guy's about. And I think, strangely, for the portion of the party that still falls into the long-lost progressive wing, there's a slight bit of more hopefulness to some of the things O'Leary is saying than there is, for example, with a candidate like Kelly Leach. So I think he might get some echo there simply because he is not... Well, it's sort of hard because his political position is kind of all over the ideological map.
Incoherent is a good word. Incoherent.
But there are elements of it that that line up with former progressive conservative values in a way that you're not seeing, except for Michael Chong, you're not seeing a lot more of from the other candidates.
Yeah, no, that's valid on O'Leary. He has talked about the need to embrace or get past same-sex marriage, which is sometimes a boogeyman for conservative candidates, LGBTQ rights. He's put front and center. He's also talked about rights for the use of bathrooms and that whole transgender bathroom debate that's taken place on the mainland. He's firmly on the right or on the progressive in the progressive middle on all of that, if not to the left, and that will probably help him. Last question for you. Do you see him winning this thing, knowing what you do about the conservative leadership race at this point and where conservatives are? Are there enough conservatives, because they will be the ones who vote first, who think that he can beat Justin Trudeau?
Well, I don't know if they will vote for him to see if he can beat Justin Trudeau. I fear that there might be enough to get him into the job of running the Conservative Party of Canada. What happens after that is anyone's guess. I mean, he hasn't shown a great interest to stay here in Canada for longer than a few days. So I don't know if he plans to be an offshore opposition leader or what he plans to do. But I would think that of all of the candidates that Trudeau might like to face in this, he's pretty far up there.
Yeah, I would think you're right. And people who haven't seen your column, your last paragraph sort of captures that sentiment. You just said that sealskin coat, if O'Leary didn't slip it back off again before heading home to Boston, U.S. customs agents would seize it. I guess the benefit, Russell, of Kevin O'Leary is you and I and millions of others will continue to talk about him, and he will probably enjoy that and see that as some form of success. Great to have you on the program. Keep writing. Always enjoy your columns. Thanks for making the time today.
No trouble. Have a good day.
The Tim Powers Show will be right back. This is the Tim Powers Show on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Well, this week, lots and lots of different polls have come out showing, for the most part, that the Liberal Party holds a commanding lead over its opposition. Now, there's been an outlier poll that suggests that they've had a bit of a dent in their support because of the recent budget. But here to talk about all of this is David Coletto. David, how are you today?
I'm well, Tim. Thanks.
So what do you make of the vast majority of these polls? Because you look at polls for trends, not standalone polls. There is one poll, I believe, Forum Research, that suggests the Liberals have been taken aback a bit by the budget. But what's your take on the way things are right now?
Well, there's been six polls done in March. All of them, except, as you mentioned, that Forum poll, have the Liberals well ahead. And their support actually increasing, that they hit a low point, I think, in February. We saw it in our poll, the gap between them and the Conservatives had shrunk a little bit. But since then, the gap has widened, except for this one poll that Forum Research did right after the budget. So we've got Nanos Research showing more than a 14-point lead for the Liberals. Approval rating, really haven't changing. And I think a lot of it has to do with fundamentals haven't really changed. While the budget came out last week and, the initial, I think, response that we've seen in the one poll that's actually asked questions about it that has been publicly released so far has been most people have liked some of the things in it. They weren't, big fans of the reduction or the elimination of the tax credit for public transit. But it wasn't a budget, I don't think, that most people felt the public would react in really strong or negative ways. And I think that's what we're seeing, that most people, it was like kind of a shrug of their shoulder. And so if I look at those numbers, I wouldn't expect the public to all of a sudden turn on the Liberals and decide that all of a sudden they no longer support them. And so I think the polls that we've seen that show the Liberal support continuing to be high make sense to me. We've done private polls for a number of clients that are showing the same thing, that we don't see any significant shift in the numbers. And so I think it's largely because, first of all, while people know there was a budget, we have to remember most Canadians, most of even your listeners, mm-hmm. probably don't know everything about what's going on in that budget, and may have been reading and listening and watching some of the commentary on it, but by and large, the motive of the government in their mind hasn't really changed. And the reason you like Justin Trudeau, if you liked him a week ago, you still like him today, pretty much holds up the same. And those are all the things that I look for. Get outside the Ottawa bubble and start to really think about what does shift public opinion. And I don't think the budget by itself is really going to do that on its own.
So how do you think the Liberals will view the rollout of the budget and the attendant commentary?
Well, I think based on how quickly they tried to change the channel, and I know we're going to talk about marijuana legalization in a moment, but they leaked the announcement of the bill coming in April on a Sunday evening, or right. at least the CBC picked it up. Whether it was a leak or not, we don't know. Suggests to me they wanted that conversation really to stop, that they knew this was a no-news budget. Most of the news was not good. They raised taxes on alcohol and tobacco. They got rid of a relatively popular, as I said, public transit tax credit without a significant amount of spending and a big budget deficit. So I think they wanted to move past it. I think this was a budget that they just needed to get out and didn't have much good news to talk about. So they look to change the channel. Are they worried that this is probably going to cause people to stop supporting the Liberals? I don't think so, but they'd rather talk about something else.
How do you think the opposition have handled the budget narrative? Because budgets provide the opportunity sometimes for the opposition party to showcase a very different perspective. On budget day, something interesting happened, albeit it was a 30-minute or a one-hour kind of circus, and that was the opposition, the Conservatives and the New Democrats, used the opportunity of procedural affairs in the House to slow the budget by 30 minutes so they could talk about a reform initiative that they were not happy with that the government was bringing forward. How might that play out for them? And the broader question, how did they do in putting up a counter narrative to the government's budget narrative?
Well, I tend to think that those procedural inside Ottawa kind of tactics, get the parliamentary press gallery all worked up and excited, but really don't break through with the general public, who, again, aren't paying that much attention to politics and, in fact, probably see it more as games and, as you described, a circus, as opposed to something that is really, having an impact. If you really dislike the government, if you are a hardcore conservative or New Democrat, you probably take some pleasure in them creating some pain for the government. But I don't think it really changes much. But I do think – I actually think the Conservatives and the New Democrats effectively messaged or countered the budget, that the rhetoric and the response that they had, while on its own, again, isn't going to fundamentally change the narrative or public opinion, that it's fitting into what you can see they're going to say come 2019, which is for the Conservatives that the Liberals and the government here in Ottawa are out of touch with most, Main Street, working, blue-collar, middle-class Canadians, right? That the things that this budget did, raising taxes on, being able to have a beer at the end of the day or taking public transit home, are things that counter go counter to what working people, what middle-class Canadians actually need. For the New Democrats, their entire narrative has been, and when they select a new leader will, I bet, continue to be, that Justin Trudeau is not the progressive that he promised he would be in the last election. And so in their response to the budget, although it was difficult because there wasn't a lot in there, they noted how the budget didn't go far enough on child care or on health care and on some of the other issues that they feel are important to those groups of voters. And so you're going to continue, I think, to see that. That's my view, is that's the vulnerability of the Liberals, that they are going to lose their left flank to the New Democrats, and those 45 and older middle-class Canadians who live in suburbs are going to wake up and say, the government really hasn't done anything for me, and maybe consider voting Conservative again. That's what I think the outcome that the two opposition parties are hoping to achieve. And I get a sense that their rhetoric, while it may not have broken through and everybody heard it, they're going to continue to repeat that. And I think that is probably their best course of action right now.
Now, you mentioned the Liberals on the Sunday night after the budget came forward and leaked a story. They almost blew a water main putting it out there that they are going to move forward with the legalization of marijuana, and that's going to happen on or by July 1st, 2018. That legislation to make that happen will be coming in the next few weeks. What was all that about beyond what you said, and what could that mean for them with some of their key voting cohorts, including various cohorts of millennials?
Yeah, well, I think it's one to change the channel on the budget, to have us stop talking about the budget and talk about this promise and the fact that they are still planning to keep a promise, right? You have to remember only a few months ago the government got in hot water with its sort of stepping away from electoral reform. So I think another high-profile promise was its promise to legalize marijuana. So it's clearly signaling it's moving in that direction. So I think that's what it's about. It's saying to younger voters who, although I question whether, I'm 35. I know lots of people who are my age and younger. This is not our number one issue. This is not an issue that we wake up, and most young people in the survey research we do not say legalizing marijuana is their top issue. But it's a signal, again, that the government's different. When you are under pressure from your opponents that, the Liberals are no different than the Conservatives or the New Democrats would have been in power, that Justin Trudeau promised to be different and he's not, one way to demonstrate you are different is, first of all, following through on a promise you made, and one is to do something that no one else has really done or even considered doing, and that's legalizing marijuana. So I think the push to put this onto the agenda, I think, speaks to all of those things that the government's trying to do. And I think it has, at least here in Ottawa, we've been talking about this far more than we've been talking about the budget, which is only released a few days ago, right? So, budget was out last Thursday. On Sunday, they leaked the story. That's not a lot of time for you to talk about the budget, which is usually what governments want to do. They don't want people to stop talking about it, which signals, again, that I think it wasn't the document or the political document they were hoping it would be or were planning it to be.
Last question, and again, it's about the opposition. Is there any opportunity for them here on marijuana, or is that ship sailed? Or is the debate going to be about safety and access, and they'll have to carve out whatever position they can? Or is resistance to this just going to be futile?
I think the data that I'm seeing suggests, more people are open to legalizing marijuana than are firmly opposed to it. There's about one out of four Canadians who say they're firmly opposed, they're probably not going to change their mind, and most of them aren't Liberal supporters in the first place, right? So, and most of them are Conservatives. So you're not going to – I don't think that group's going to be convinced otherwise. But I do think there's some risk for the government. I think this is one of the riskier policy choices, policy directions they're going to take, because it's so rarely been done in other jurisdictions how do they know how to implement this? We only have a few examples in the United States, and that wasn't at a national level. That was in a number of states. I think it's interesting that they are giving the provinces the responsibility of doing the hard work, of making the harder decisions, which is how do you distribute, who can access the drug. And I think that's where the politics probably gets more complicated. If you're Dwight Ball's government, you're figuring out how do we get marijuana distributed in the province. There's a lot more, I think, pitfalls in deciding how to get that out, lots more politics involved than in simply regulating who can produce the drug and what can be in it, right, and the laws around that. So I think there's still lots of risk for the federal government, but I actually see more risk at the provincial level in deciding how they actually distribute it, who can distribute it, and where people can access it, because that's really the concern of the public, is I don't want my, you know, underage kids getting access. I don't want to see people walking down the street, you know, high all the time. I don't want people driving while they've used the drug. Those are all things that the government needs to be really careful of, and it's going to be, I think, require partnership with the provinces to be able to implement it successfully. But, you know, while it may be supported by some people, I think a lot of people are still on edge about what this really means. It's such a significant change in how we think about drugs and access and all those kinds of things.
All right. Well, we will be watching it. It promises to be an interesting 16-month debate and discussion, and it will be cool to see how the opposition does deal with it, because I think, particularly on the conservative side, they do have some opportunities, particularly if they want to connect with millennials to have a responsible dialogue here. We will be talking about it more. Great to have you on the show today, David. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.